Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 4 months ago, President Bush stood on the deck of the USS Lincoln and spoke directly about the links between terrorism and the regime of Saddam Hussein.
The liberation of Iraq is a crucial advance in the campaign against terror. We've removed an ally of Al-Qaeda and cut off a source of terrorist funding. And this much is certain. No terrorist network will gain weapons of mass destruction from the Iraqi regime, because the regime is no more.
Just last week, Vice President Dick Cheney said he was not surprised that most people in America think Saddam Hussein was involved in the 9/11 attacks. Then President Bush clarified the connection.
No, we've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September the 11th. Now, what the Vice President said was that he has been involved with Al-Qaeda.
Connection listeners, it is against this backdrop of mixed messages that the Bush administration takes its case formally to the United Nations. The President is expected to explain why he initially said that the U.S. did not need the involvement of the U.N. and why he's now asking for help. We'd like to hear from you this hour. Do you support the administration's new appeal for a multilateral approach? Do these contradictions in the administration's case change your commitment in any way to a sustained U.S. involvement? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, we're going to start today with the White House correspondent for The New York Times, David Sanger, is joining us from Washington. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Your piece this morning, David, says that when Mr. Bush takes to the podium tomorrow at the United Nations, he's not going to acknowledge any mistake at all in planning.
That's right. Certainly in planning the post-war part. There had been some expectation that this speech, because he is going to the U.N. seeking, as you said, troops and cash, would be somewhat more conciliatory. And it will be to the extent that I don't think you'll hear the kind of declaration you heard last time, that the U.N. was on the verge of irrelevance. But he is not going to be in any way apologetic for the decision to go into Iraq, or the kind of planning that went into the post-war period. People who have worked on the speech are telling me that, in fact, the essence of his argument is going to be, we can all agree on one thing, none of us wants to ever have to do in Iraq again. And that means we have to focus on other threats involving weapons of mass destruction, mostly nuclear threats, and that's code words for North Korea and Iran. And then he will make the argument, as he did 2 weeks ago in his speech to the country from the Cabinet Room, that the U.N. has a responsibility, whether they agreed or not with the decision to go into Iraq, to now make it a working democracy.
All right, but David, he does this against the backdrop of the past week when we were hearing different things from Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Powell, and Bush. And I'm wondering what you can tell us about what's going on inside the White House these days.
Well, it's a little bit of a mystery. What started all of this was Vice President Cheney's comments to Tim Russert on Meet the Press. And he was asked a very simple question, which was, do you believe there's any link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11? And rather than offer the answer that almost everyone else in the administration has given publicly, which is, no, we have no evidence of that, he came back and said, Tim, we don't know. And then he went on to say, if you read the whole transcript, we don't have any evidence, but we do know that he was closely linked to Al-Qaeda. It was a guilt by association thing. This built, the way these stories frequently do, over a period of days, to the point that when someone finally asked the president, he was ready with an answer, which was to try to put the whole thing out by saying, no, there is no evidence of a link to 9/11. Now, the question is, why did Cheney do this? One theory is it just reflects what he really believes. He believes that there was a link. We just haven't found the evidence yet. Another possibility is that he believes that to fully justify the invasion of Iraq, we need to at least keep the lingering possibility out there.
Do you believe, David, that this in any way undermines the administration case that it's going to make to the rest of the world tomorrow at the U.N. or here in the country or to Congress?
Well, it may have more of an effect here in the country, I think, than it does in the U.N. In the U.N., there are, I think, two major objections that are at work here, and that, of course, you have to think of this as sort of a continuum between skepticism and anger. authority, that he wasn't able to get that second resolution. And in the world of the UN, that's a much bigger issue than anything Dick Cheney says. The second point is that the weapons of mass destruction that the president talked so much about a year ago when he went to the UN still have not been found. And when he speaks tomorrow, he's only going to talk about this briefly and say, we have a team over there, you know, the team led by David Kaye, and we'll report back to you when we hear from them. He is not going to dwell on what has or has not been found.
Let me just ask you briefly before you go then, David, about how this is playing out and will play out in the country, because late last Friday we listened to a new sort of tone in the Democratic attack that's being taken against the president's position. Just a couple of comments here from Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts.
There was no imminent threat. This was made up in Texas, announced in January by to the Republican leadership that the war was going to take place and was going to be good politically, and this whole thing was fraud.
Well, this whole thing, he says, was a fraud. And this, as the administration officials go to all those congressional committees this week, David, asking for that money.
Well, that is going to be a big problem for them here, and they are going to have a similar and related problem at the UN. Look, in the 2 weeks since the president gave that speech to the nation, he has made very little progress on getting any countries to chip in more than $1 billion or so dollars, which out of an $87 billion project is not very much. At most, if they're lucky, they're going to get 10,000 to 15,000 foreign troops. Again, not very much in an area where we're now using 140,000 to 150,000 total troops, of which 130 are U.S. So he has not made much progress, and these two are feeding off of each other. If the U.N. is unwilling to contribute, it's going to be more difficult to get Congress to contribute at least that $20 billion of the $87 billion that goes toward reconstruction. I think the amount that the president has asked for, that $66 billion for the troops, no one would dare vote against, or very few. And then there's a political issue, which is that to some degree, you hear among the Democrats their sense that for the first time there's a chink in the armor out here, and if they can keep going on the theme that Senator Kennedy hit last week, and which you'll hear the president strike back out in an interview he did yesterday with Fox News, it'll be broadcast tonight, that then they have a wedge in here to attacking the post-war planning. And since they don't know which way the economy is going to look, you know, come February or March or next spring when the presidential election heats up, this is, for now, their angle of attack.
David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. I'd like to introduce my two guests for the hour now. Joining me here in the Boston studio, John Newhouse. He's the author of numerous essays and books. His most recent, just out, is called Imperial America, The Bush Assault on the World Order. John covered foreign policy for The New Yorker magazine from 1980 to 1994. He's currently senior fellow at the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. John, it's good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Joining us also today from a studio at WNYC in New York is Abraham Sofer. He is senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where he is also a professor at the law school there. He served as legal advisor to the U.S. State Department during the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Abraham, it's nice to have you with us.
Good morning.
I want to ask you first, in just reflecting on what David Sanger had to tell us, whether or not you think that one key to the Bush administration moving ahead in its Iraq policy is some kind of admission at the United Nations that it made a mistake.
I hope not. They don't seem to be ready to admit anything.
Should they, though?
Certainly, it doesn't matter whether they admit something or not. What matters is that they recognize that there's very little difference between the position stated by Powell and others in the administration, including Jerry Bremer's off-stated positions, and France's position at this point. France's call for a rapid and definitive shift of sovereignty is really more or less a demand for a symbolic shift of sovereignty from the, quote, occupying power of the United States to the Iraqi Council, and we've promised to do that. We've promised to do that as quickly as possible. I think we should find a way to do that, And whether that is admitting a mistake doesn't have to be addressed explicitly, but clearly it would be the right thing to do at this point.
John Newhouse, will that admission in your view make a difference at this point?
Well, it would make a difference if he were prepared to do it. Bush is in a tough spot of his own making. He needs help from the international community, and he needs to blur this heavy U.S. footprint in Iraq. He and Chirac are both taking what for now are advanced positions. Bush isn't really conceding anything, or certainly not very much. And Chirac is trying to demonstrate that he is the leading edge of a wedge driving the U.S. toward acceptance of a more international role. I mean, it's a slow dance. It's a pas de deux. And eventually they will get reasonably close together, close enough to make a deal. There will be a resolution.
But you've been saying that this administration now looks clearly like it's in over its head on this one.
I think it is over its head.
Why?
Well, because it made a whole list of mistakes. There was no rationale for the war. Senator Kennedy said it's brutal language, but I think it's true.
But
it was a fraud. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
No, basically the case they made for the war was the connection, the alleged connection between Saddam and 9/11, that is to say Al-Qaeda, and the fact that they were building weapons of mass destruction, not only building them, but prepared to turn them over to terrorists such as Al-Qaeda, who in turn might use them against the United States. Now, all of that went entirely against what they were being told by the larger part, in fact, virtually all of the intelligence community in this town, that the last thing Saddam would do, because it would be so potentially self-injurious, to turn over weapons to a terrorist organization that he could not control, and who, if they used the weapons, they would could very well have Saddam's fingerprints on them, and that would lead to his own destruction. So rogue governments like Saddam's don't traffic with non-state terrorist organizations.
Abraham Sofer, well, briefly, what do you think about this? Is there a are we talking about a serious contradiction here?
Absolutely not. The war is not a fraud. The war was properly supported by 75% of the Congress and actually overwhelmingly supported by the international community in the form of some 16 UN resolutions, many of which rested on many, many grounds other than the possession of weapons of mass destruction, although even that ground was established beyond doubt repeatedly with regard to Iraq, as well as the fact that he was willing to use weapons of mass destruction. That was also established. Listen, when you tell someone like Saddam that you're coming in 6 months, you're coming in 4 months, etc., it's hardly surprising that when you come, you don't find the weapons there anymore.
All right, we'll pick this up when we come back after the break. Connection listeners, do you support the administration's new shift for a more multilateral approach? We'll be hearing more of that later this week when the president makes his speech to the United Nations. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And Connection listeners, this is the day before the day that the president is to make his speech to the United Nations. We're taking a look at what his options are and how people there will be hearing the message from the administration at this time and how they'll be receiving all the news of what appear to be contradictions from among the different members of the administration at this time, how that will affect the administration making its case before the world. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, John Newhouse, author of Imperial America, The Bush Assault on the World Order, and joining us from New York, Abraham Sofer, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Abe, let me just come back to you and allow you to finish the answer to the question that you were talking about, because this question of whether or not the Bush administration has a contradiction that it has to deal with, that it has to resolve in terms of explaining its rationale for the war, that seems to me to quite significantly be affecting the the weight of the administration making its case before the UN, if people are going to sit around wondering if the administration's got its act together.
I hope you're not right. John Newhouse is right that the administration did do things that I thought were unwise. I really could not understand why this administration insisted on becoming the first occupying power since the Second World War. I think what we did in Afghanistan was worked. It worked. It was modest. We made much less of a commitment, it's true. We did not have the expectations that we have with Iraq. But we worked through the UN. We had a council there, and it's called the Loya Jirga, that we approved of, that we helped form. We've done a similar thing in Iraq with the council there, the governing council, but we've insisted on being the occupying power, and that's really what this is all about, it seems to me, and John Newhouse is right. We should give up that power, and so is Chirac. We should figure out a way to shift that authority, that symbolic authority, to the council as quickly as possible under some kind of an arrangement where the council will recognize that the United States has to go on providing security, has to go on doing a number of things under the UN flag as well as under the U.S. flag. And that's what we need to do. And I am worried that the people in the administration who insisted on using this formula of the occupying power to begin with will, in fact, interfere with a reasoned shift which the president desperately needs, not only for purposes of doing Iraq well, but for domestic political purposes as well.
John Newhouse, it doesn't really sound, from what David Sanger was telling us, that the administration is anywhere near close to giving up its occupying power status that Abe's describing. Would that make the difference at the UN at this point?
Well, I don't think anyone, certainly not among the allies of the United States, expects the U.S. to concede the control of the security of Iraq. Nobody wants that. Nobody's prepared to step in and help substantially to ease the U.S. role there. But I think what people want to see otherwise is a division of labor, with the UN specialized agencies playing a role, with other governments that have special capabilities in Iraq, with a history in Iraq coming in. And this U.S. identity or footprint there has to be blurred, because only if that happens will the Iraqis stop attacking their own resources, such as their pipelines, such as killing each other, those who appear to be helping the Americans. And in other words, in order to discourage the bloodletting, there has to be a diminishment of the U.S. imagery, which is so unpleasant to Iraqis right now.
Help me, though, bring this back to what's going to happen at the United Nations. You've been covering these types of sessions for a long time. Does the Bush administration re-enter the General Assembly or the Security Council rooms this fall significantly diminished? Is this a time when those European countries will be wagging their fingers and saying, I told you so? Is this a time when the other nations will be saying, look, you made this bed, we're not going to supply you with the troops and the money that you want?
Well, I think that's probably what's going to happen, because these other governments are pushing on what seems to be a partially open door. And we heard David Sanger say what's going on in Washington right now is a bit of a mystery. Why did Cheney say one thing and then Rumsfeld 2 days later say a different thing? What Rumsfeld and Bush did in the same week was unsay things that they had said repeatedly over the past year, that there was this link between al-Qaeda and Iraq. Why is this happening? We don't know, except that the administration may be, I don't know, but may be reaching out to other governments. How far and how fast this process of reaching out will go, we'll just have to wait and see.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Roxboro, North Carolina. Ryan's joining us. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
How are you? You're welcome. Thanks for taking the call. Just wanted to make a quick point, if you can still hear me.
I can, Ryan. It's not a great connection, but go ahead.
Okay. That I don't feel in any way misled by the president or anyone in his administration. I think he was extra careful not to make a connection between the specific 9/11 and Iraq. I think he has said that they think there may be collaboration between, or may have been collaboration between, Saddam and elements of al-Qaeda prior to 9/11. But simply because 7 out of 10 Americans believe that there was this connection doesn't mean it's so.
Where do you think those 7 out of 10 Americans got that idea? Well, I mean, it seems to me that for the past 6 or 8 months, the administration has been hinting very heavily about links that exist, certainly between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's regime.
That's certainly open to interpretation, I suppose, but he has not outright said there's a direct Saddam Hussein was the perpetrator of 9/11. Quite to the contrary. They assigned blame to the guilty party, al-Qaeda, and I just don't feel in any way misled. Simply because 7 out of 10 Americans believe that it's so doesn't mean it.
Okay, I got that. What do you want the president? What do you want to hear the president saying tomorrow, Ryan?
Just to keep it. Not to concede very much to the Europeans, that if they'd like to come on board, we'd be more than happy to have them. But I don't think he should go there on hand and foot. They didn't shed any blood in this venture, and I don't think they should deserve any control for their apathy.
Abe Sofer, let me hear from you here. Does the president go on bended knee, I think is what Ryan was hinting at?
Well, the president has a lot of fish to fry at the UN, not just Iraq. The president's primary concern is nuclear power in the hands of what he called the evil empire, in a sense. And these countries, North Korea and Iran in particular, are a major danger, not just to the United States, but to many other places in the world. And the UN is, if anything, inclined to go along with that premise and to work hard to make sure we don't have to have another war to prevent another huge terrorist attack with some kind of a nuclear device provided by a country like North Korea.
I know the president will be talking tomorrow about Iran and North Korea.
That's right, but things are connected.
But come back to Iraq, though, because the big suspicion or question is whether or not the administration overstated the case in suggesting that Iraq was closer to its nuclear capability than now appears to be the case.
Well, that quote, the stuff about Africa, that was not just an overstatement. It was wrong. But certainly Saddam was trying before the war to gain nuclear capability. But the point, the connection, is not the kind of superficial thing that, forgive me, the press seems to love to play with, but the very profound fact that the president doesn't have to be on bended knee to develop a rational solution to the Iraq problem because he is asking for so much else that the UN seems, and France and others, seem so ready to provide. So the president has to go in there with an overall strategy that includes both objectives.
John Newhouse.
Well, again, I think I could agree with certainly some of that. There has to be kind of a convergence of the U.S. responsibilities and the allies, the government's willingness in their own interests to help and to begin to rebuild and stabilize Iraq. But the president could really be doing himself and all of us a huge favor if he conceded the fact that Iran never really was a serious threat.
Iraq. Sorry.
I'm getting ahead of myself. Iraq was a serious threat in terms of unconventional weapons because it wasn't. Right now we have journalists in Iraq who are being told by the Iraqi scientists who are now free to speak out, the ones most closely involved with his unconventional weapons programs, that they disbanded the teams creating nuclear capabilities back in 1991 after the Gulf War. And that they were nowhere really on the biological chemical weapons partially because they knew that inspectors were coming and that there was going to be a very tough inspections regime. The real threats in terms of these so-called weapons of mass destruction, unconventional weapons, are from North Korea and Pakistan, and I would say less so at this point still from Iran. Now, the only country that really fits the Bush description of evil and wicked behavior is Pakistan. First of all, it shelters Taliban. The Taliban controls two of its provinces, and al-Qaeda has a haven there. Pakistan is the most turbulent, unstable of all these countries. Pakistan has developed nuclear weapons. We don't know how many there are or where they are. We think we know how many there are, but we don't know much about how the command and control of these weapons. But much more important, it was Pakistan on its own initiative that made possible the North Korean nuclear program. Pakistan provided everything they needed in terms of training, centrifuges, other materials, and technology. We're doing far too little about Pakistan. Admittedly, the Musharraf government is probably the most stable there is. But we should, instead of all this focus on Iraq, the focus on the sources of all these problems, I think, was wholly misdirected.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Boston, Massachusetts, and Nick's joining us. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I'd like to suggest that appearing at the United Nations could be the latest in a series of huge political blunders by George Bush. I think we know the tone that he'll adopt. It's the only tone that he has. I think he's facing a population at the UN and in the countries behind those members.
What are you saying, Nick, that he's already burned all the bridges that he had there and there's no point showing up unless he's going to completely change his tune?
I think he shouldn't turn up because he can't change his tune. For domestic reasons, he can't go that one necessary step further. So he'll go to the United Nations and he'll hector and he'll be sanctimonious and he'll not be prepared to listen or to discuss any of the issues there. I think the aftermath of his speech will demonstrate how much he squandered the feelings around 9/11 towards the United States that were universal around the world. I think the aftermath will demonstrate that there are no other political leaders in the world who are going to do what Tony Blair's done, which is basically to surrender his position. I think we'll see in the next few months in order to support Bush. So I actually can't understand why he's going. I think to send Powell there and allow Powell to take the flak would make much more sense.
All right, Nick, thanks a lot for your call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Abe Sofer, he can't go or shouldn't go to the United Nations because he can't say what he ought to say for domestic reasons. What do you think?
I certainly disagree with that. He should go and he should say what he believes is right. And I think the president said many things during his campaign for the presidency that are consistent with a much more humble and responsible approach to what the very serious problem of international terrorism than the one that is reflected in the occupying power issue and the decision by people who have been running the Iraq show from the Pentagon. And I think the president is, I hope, in the process of shifting away from a policy that is, I think, more dangerous to the United States than almost anything, perhaps even than terrorism itself. That is this policy that we go into countries, take them over, and even where we are acting in our self-defense, that part of the price is that we have to redo the country, we have to have our children killed at a rate of about one a day. We have to spend billions of our dollars to do that. I just don't think that that's a feasible national security strategy. We have to be able to defend ourselves in a feasible way with the international community's participation in those efforts, as we did in Afghanistan and as we must do in North Korea and Iran and Pakistan, incidentally, as well.
Let me bring John Newhouse in here, because, John, in your new book, you make the point that the Bush administration had its moment in the hours and the days after 9/11 when it really could have done this kind of all-inclusive, multilateral reaching out to the world to you know, sort of join in the fight on terrorism. And they didn't do that at that time. So if that's been the stance of the Bush administration now for the past 2 years, can Bush go to the United Nations, as our caller Nick suggested, with a substantially different message? Or is he handcuffed by what he has to say for domestic consumption based on what he's been saying for the past couple of years?
No, I don't think he's handcuffed. I think the country wants to hear some of what the world wants to hear. The country will support him. The country isn't going to support a policy of having gone in there and surrendered American lives and spent a great deal of money in order to try to undo the regime of Saddam Hussein and then run away. The country will stay the course, but the country also wants to hear that he's going to socialize the risks, that is, to bring in other governments to share in the financial and human costs of rebuilding Iraq.
But again,
I would come back to the point, though, if you want a realistic strategic policy, it should, as in the case of the post 9/11 period, focus on the real threats, or the real problems, the real threats to stability. They are the Middle East, particularly the peace process, Pakistan, as I said before, North Korea, which I think is an easy one, by the way, and Iran. In fact, Colin Powell called North Korea a no-brainer. This was on background to the press during his confirmation hearings. You just build on what the Clinton administration had done in North Korea. The administration spent 2 years before it even sat down to talk with the North Koreans, and time moves on, and their nuclear weapons program has advanced. In Iran, I think the Iranians are still waiting to make a deal with us. Fortunately, the Europeans have stepped in and have put a lot of pressure on the Iranians and are dealing with those forces in Iran that want to avoid going over the nuclear threshold. But that may not be possible unless the United States steps in and aligns itself with what the Europeans are, in effect, with what the Europeans are trying to do in Iran.
Connection listeners, is this administration willing to make those steps to align itself with European policy, to widen out its conversation about a war on terrorism to include Pakistan and North Korea and Iran? And is the world ready to take the president at his word, move ahead rather than dwell on what the inconsistencies may have been over the past year in Iraq itself? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And on the Monday of the week that President George W. Bush returns to the United Nations, Connection listeners, we're exploring what his options are, how he's going to be received, and how you're watching the president's return to the United Nations, whether or not you have specific ideas about what you'd like to hear him say. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Boston, and Charlie's on the line. Hi, Charlie.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I wanted to say I think the president is handcuffed not by the American people, but he's handcuffed by his own policies and by his advisors, who are saying he has to push forward with this idea of the U.S. Inserting its, as someone said, his footprint around the world. Making the footprint fuzzy by bringing in troops from other countries is not going to change the fact that it's the U.S. footprint. Letting other countries' children die for a war that the U.S. started is not a solution. We have to take the U.S. occupation out of Iraq so that we can even talk about solutions to the problems we've created there. My son is in the Marines. He returned at the end of May from this situation, but we are now extending the stays of our National Guard, our reserves. We're destroying our military, and we're destroying our relations with people around the world by this arrogance.
But, Charlie, you're saying also that you're not likely to be able to get Europeans Europeans or other soldiers involved over there. So what's the alternative?
Well, if somebody came to you and said, I'd like you to send your son over to be killed in another country, but you don't have any say in what's going on, and, in fact, only one country is going to have a say, and that's a country that's basically spat in the face of the UN last time around. What would you say?
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is whether or not there's anything that the president can say at this point this week before the UN that changes the equation you're describing.
Well, I think there's one thing the president could say, which he won't say. He could say he was wrong. It wasn't a mistake. They knew what they were doing, but he was wrong to do what he was doing, that he is putting in place plans to remove the U.S. military occupation and to ask for help in that effort.
Charlie, thanks a lot for your call. John Newhouse Is there any precedent for a president making the sort of, hey, we made a mistake, help us move ahead type appeal to the UN that Charlie's describing?
I cannot think of one. That doesn't mean to say, though, that it won't happen.
Right.
He's not going to do a big mea culpa, that's for sure. But I think he will begin to edge U.S. policy in a different and more international direction. It'll be kind of tiny steps for tiny feet. Colin Powell may follow up with a speech, and we begin to see a little movement. It'll be slow. I don't know that this is going to happen, but my guess would be that we will see slowly some movement in this direction.
But you have also studied this administration and written about it as one that is not in any way inclined to be conciliatory, that they are a very tight and closed circle, and I'm not sure whether or not there's any evidence of a change there.
No, I agree with you. The evidence would suggest that they won't budge. But that was then, and this is now. As I think I said before, now they are in over their heads. They may have been in over their head before, but they didn't realize it. I mean, there was all this airy talk about invading Iraq and lighting a torch and democracy would sweep through the region and, you know, all of that good stuff. But I think they know better now. That, you know, they're in the real world now. They weren't really living in the real world.
Abe, let me hear you on this.
Well, I think it's very important to keep this in perspective. I don't agree with John Newhouse at all that the administration has done a poor job in the war on terrorism. I think this administration has done a admirable job and a very necessary one, first by going into Afghanistan, by destroying the Taliban regime, by closing down those camps that have produced 100,000 or so trained terrorists while we sat around for 9 years and did nothing about it, and then by going into Iraq, by attacking a man who it was committed to support terror everywhere, and by attacking the funding of terrorism, by attacking fundamentalism throughout the world, and enhancing and advancing women's rights and the right to freedom of religion and other important principles. This is a major war, as the president properly said.
So you're saying there's no reason for any mea culpa?
Absolutely not. What needs to be done is a tactical shift in Iraq in order for us to fight the overall war more effectively.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Southern Pines, North Carolina, Brandon's joining us. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Listen, I think the real issue today is whether or not we should have attacked the Iraqis or not. Today, the issue is 130,000 excess of troops. We need to figure out a way to get home. I think the American government, the political players, should get together, come together, and create this government for the Iraqis so they can push forward on their own for let our players come home and let us worry about our own more than what we've done.
Don't you think the people in the White House are doing pretty close to that, Brandon, figuring out a fast way out?
It does seem that way, but today's issues, a lot of the conversation today is whether we should or should not have invaded Iraq, and I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is creating a government in Iraq so we can get our troops home.
Here's the link that I see between those two points, Brandon, and that is that the president has to go to the United Nations and make a case for other countries to send their soldiers. And so the question is, how much does the president have to back up the tape of the last year and say, we made a mistake here, or we did something wrong there, and here's why? I mean, you know, think about it. 2 or 3 months ago, in June and July, the president was saying, we don't want any help. We don't need extra soldiers, and we don't need investors. We can deal with the problem.
I can appreciate that. But still, I think that today's issue is what it is. And whether or not he was right or wrong, whether you support Bush or not, we have 130,000 excess of troops that are policing the country that probably don't want us there to start off with. What do you do about that? Do you fuss about whether or not we should have gone there or not?
No, I get your point, Brandon. I appreciate your call. Abe, do you want to start on this?
Dick, yeah, I'd like to say something. I'd like to say that government is there already. It's the council. The governing council is there. Ministers to every department have been appointed. There's a foreign minister. They are now claiming their international seats at the Arab League and the UN.
Well, they don't have any real power, Abe.
They have the power to review the budget and approve it. They have other powers that have been delegated to them. The problem is that we are the occupying power and have to give them all the power they get. And what they're doing now is lobbying in Washington to get Congress and the president to shift this issue and give them the sovereign power. And Chirac is ready to accept the governing council, our governing council, as the entity to which sovereign power would be given. So I think we're very close, and I think the administration should grasp this opportunity to move this process forward along the lines that your caller suggested.
John.
Well, I would agree that the administration should grasp this opportunity, if that's what it is, and I think perhaps it is a small opportunity. But the fact is that the council is appointed by us. It is still perceived by the Iraqis, by and large, to be a creature of the United States. And I think, again, this is going to be slow going. There may be some forward movement, but it is going. It will be measured and gradual. I think it's going to be tough to begin to remove this heavy American identity on what's going on there. And in the meantime, a lot of people, American soldiers and Iraqis themselves, are going to be killed. And the international community, in its own interests, will do what it can to begin to share the burden with the United States. But politically, that's hard to do, too. It's just as it's hard for Bush to reach out beyond a certain point. It's hard for the international community to meet him halfway. It will, in the end, in its own interests, because they share the same interest we have in stabilizing Iraq and preventing it from being what it really wasn't in the past, which was a major source of instability.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next call from Watertown, Massachusetts, and John's joining us. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I've been listening, and you know, I feel like we're reliving history again. I mean, we look back to the 60s when we got into Vietnam, and it was this war we had against monolithic communism. And I think we should have learned then that there was no monolithic communism we had to deal with back then. And Vietnam was a terrible mistake, as I would hope your speakers would agree on. But then we come to Iraq, and now we're fighting this war against, you know, Islamic fundamental terrorism, and we're lumping all this into one group as well, too. So we're getting, to me, bogged down again, once again in a place we should not be in. And it's just costing us, you know, lots of lives, whether it be American and Iraqi lives, and, of course, lots of money as well, too. I think it's like we're reliving Vietnam all over again. I'd just like to hear what the speakers have to say in terms of do they feel Vietnam was a big mistake, and are we in fact going on with reliving this history that we should have learned back in, you know, back in the 60s and 70s?
All right, John. First to John Newhouse here in the studio.
Yes, our overcommitment in Vietnam was a big mistake for which we paid heavily over the years. I think what we've done in Iraq was, first of all, a mistake, and I think it is harming the country, harming the world, and we will pay heavily for it. I think the problem was that the heavy focus on terrorism was misdirected toward Iraq when it should have been on restarting the Middle East peace process, on negotiating a deal, which I think could have been made easily enough with North Korea, because they wanted a deal with their program. Their weapons, advanced weapons programs, are there to be sold politically. But if they can't sell them politically, that is to say with us, they'll sell them commercially. Again, Iran is analogous in the sense that it wants to get the U.S. attention, and it's doing that. But Iran could go over the nuclear threshold if we're not very, very careful about this. Meanwhile, Pakistan remains the greatest source of instability. And Iran, next door to Pakistan, in my opinion, is the potential agent of stability in this very troubled world, this very troubled part of the world.
Abe, just speak, if you would, a little bit about John's sense that Vietnam wasn't about Vietnam, it was about this great fight about against communism, and that the United States is making the same mistake again, picking small targets, putting them all under the umbrella of international terrorism, and getting bogged down that way.
Well, the fight against communism was a great and noble fight that was fought by Democrats and Republicans alike, starting with Harry Truman, and which we won. Vietnam was a mistake because we lost that battle. and it was a terribly fought battle and an ill-conceived effort. But the war on terrorism is in that sense similar to the war against communism, which we have now won as far as the Soviet Union is concerned. And we must fight this war on terrorism in a nonpartisan manner. It is absolutely ludicrous not to forget that this is a war that's been declared on us. The fundamentalists in Afghanistan, led by al-Qaeda at their camps, perpetrated some 8 major terrorist actions against the United States over a period of about 8 years. And they did so very deliberately and openly. We failed to take them on. They grew. The numbers have grown. Their power has grown. The money has been flowing to them. They've been training and preaching hatred to us.
Abe, I need to interrupt you here because we're very tight for time. I just want to know, what's the one thing you want to hear from the president when he speaks tomorrow?
That we have to win that war. And part of winning that war is realizing that we have to share the burden in Iraq and move forward together internationally to deal with the next challenge.
John Newhouse, what do you need to hear from the president tomorrow?
Well, I'd like to hear something along those lines, too. But I'd also like to hear something that conveys the sense that in the years ahead, the battle of ideas between the West and radical Islam is going to be controlling, just as the West was fighting fascism and communism back in the second half of the 20th century. And I think the so-called war on terrorism is really a function of this and a unilateral policy and arbitrary application of hard power is not going to advance our interests.
John Newhouse, thanks so much for coming in. It's good to have you here. And Abraham Sofer, nice to have you with us. We talked earlier in the program with David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Special thanks today to Neil Golub at NPR station WNYC in New York City. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.